Douglas Glover.
Can you hear me? No.
Douglas Glover.
Maybe I, you know that. Okay. It's really going to not take very long, and then you can all go back to your rooms. I'm really tired. And I had this all written out, but, you know, I'm just going to talk and then move on to the handout. Have you all got handouts? Are there any? Yeah. There's a, they're over there, Virginia, I think, on the chair. This is, the handouts include this kind of reading rubric that I often give students, okay, that sort of outlines how to read, especially when I'm working with people who are not used to writing critical papers, which is pretty much everybody up to fourth semester. And then after that, the there are some. Is this okay? Okay. There are some examples of bad readings of this story by Elizabeth Talent that then is the last piece in the handout. Now, do any of you know this little story called No One's a Mystery? Really? Really, such an excellent story. And for a story that's still under copyright, amazingly available on the internet. I don't know what she thinks about that. But it's here, and I did not copy it from a book. It was like one of five instances that are freely available on the internet. Okay, so what happens is that when I get students, you know, I find that, you know, that virtually everyone here is a very intelligent, college-educated reader. But very often it's hard for you to translate that into reading as a writer. Okay, and I always feel that one of my jobs as a teacher is to teach you to go beyond needing a teacher. That is, to teach you the ability to teach yourselves how to write. And as one of my great teachers, or actually the only great teacher, actually the only teacher I ever had is any good, said one day, literature is an encyclopedia of technique, you know, as long as you know how to read for it. What I find is that there are certain kind of systematic mistakes that people make when they try to read, okay, when they try to write critical papers. And this goes, most, you know, the example I use is fiction, but this goes for creative nonfiction and quite probably for poetry as well, I don't know. What happens when people read for me to begin with is that they often come back with essays that are somewhat like the critical essays they wrote at college, which are very heavy on certain sorts of interpretation, okay? They tend to tell me what a story means. You tend to look for symbols and tell me what they mean. Some people go as far as to tell me what they associate with certain items they see in the story, okay? And they think that that's reading the story, they think that in fact the author meant them to find those associations, to make those associations. You think that in fact that's part of what reading is. And it is, okay? This is not to say that all kinds of reading other than reading as a writer are invalid. That's just patently false. It's just that when you're trying to teach yourselves to read as writers, you have to change gears in very clear ways, it seems to me, okay? What happens is you just don't seem to think you have enough to say about a piece of writing without going off into associations or interpretations or story summary of sorts, you know. Instead of telling me how a story is working, people will tell me what it says, you know, tell me the storyline or things like that. So anyway, there's these ways. Now, this is not... Again, it's not a bad thing. We have a culture-wide bent towards interpretation, okay, that goes way, way, way back to the Greeks and to the Hebrews. There's this whole tradition of the Midrash, which is nothing but highly inventive and creative interpretations of biblical text. Okay, because what happens, like the Jews were faced with a text that was historical. Even when they started looking at it, they started rereading it after they came back from Babylon, and they couldn't quite get it to mean what they wanted it to mean. So they had to interpret it, because of course God must have meant the right thing. So then they built this huge lore of interpretations. Very interesting. But then the Greeks did exactly the same thing with their early texts. Okay, and then so you have Philo of Alexandria, who gives both Jews, Christians, and everybody else the idea of allegory, that everything has this undermeaning. The Greeks call it hyponia, the undermeaning. Okay, we have a culture-wide penchant for doing that. You have to stop doing it. Okay, when you read as a writer, you have to pay attention to the exact words on the text. The author does not mean more than he says on the page, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, that you just look for that. As a writer, that's what you look for. Okay. So that's what happens when you read stories through the semester. There's that mistake. What this also leads to another mistake when you're reading stories in workshop, which is kind of an interesting mistake. You develop a kind of midrashic reading of each other's stories. you kind of approach the text as if the author meant every word he or she wrote, and that all that matters is that you interpret it correctly. So that I sit in workshop and people will come and say, this is beautiful writing, it means this and this, and this character I see is like this, she wants this and she wants this, and therefore, you know, and after, you know, this is the way she's interacting with the story, you know, and we get this, you know, highly imaginative construct that goes way, way above what the text actually says, okay? You know, you'll say things like, you know, my aunt did exactly this sort of thing when, you know, she was 16, okay? I call this filling in, you know. And actually, there's a critical, you know, construct even about that, because as you know, Terence Hawkes, the critic, says, the reader completes the story, okay? There's a theoretical backing for doing that, except that don't do it! You know, it's really wrong if you're trying to learn to read as a writer. And if you're trying to critique each other's stories as writers, okay, you look at the text, see what's there. So in interpreting too much and filling in are really are things that happen a lot, and they get in the way of you seeing what's really going on. And this happens in CNF and in fiction both. It goes both ways. I had a student last semester, then say, what do you do? How do you change yourself? You know, and it's an interesting story. A student of mine last semester, we were talking this over about the third packet when she was still getting beaten up for not reading properly. She said that she was in workshop with David Jouse last winter. And they'd been working on a student story, and he pulled out a tiny little moment, a line, a few words, and it was kind of a crucial moment of criticism in his analysis of the story. And someone in the workshop said, well, you wouldn't have noticed that if you were reading this as a work of literature. You know, if you were just reading it, you wouldn't have picked up on that. It's just because you're in workshop. And he said, no. He said, I read everything the same way. You know, I read literature this way, and I read workshop stories this way, with the same kind of attention to detail and the words on the page. And the student found this very daunting, like, oh my God, that's a hell of a lot of work you have to do, you know, beyond having fun reading the story, you know. And thought, you know, I can't do that, okay. And my response was that, well, look, David is a professional, and he's been doing this for years and years and years, and he's trained himself, and it's like learning to hit a golf ball or play tennis. You know, you practice the moves over and over again, and after a while they get to be actually pretty pro forma for you. You start to, instead of having to read the story over five times, you can read it over once and you can get all the points because you're reading very carefully and you know what to look for. So the thing is, you begin to train yourselves, and that's what I feel like I try to do with the students that go through me in the program. And by the way, I've had to teach people who have PhDs and teach English literature at college. I've had to sort of say, no, don't do that. You have to back off and do this. It's a different way of thinking about writing, okay, than you're normally used to. So then we're going to get to the reading rubric. How many people have I given this to, by the way? Is there some people here? You've had it. Have I given it to you? Yeah. Maybe. Okay. Just a couple of little minor moments. A really crucial thing, although I was already reading with the pen at the time, I remember finding in Virginia Woolf's notebooks a little note where she says that she can't imagine how people read without a pencil in their hands. First thing. Now, the other thing is that I also keep a running notebook of technical information, okay? When I identify a technical issue, a device pattern, I write it out and describe it for myself. Sometimes I give it a name if I have to give it, you know, if I want. If it's something that is really crucial, I give it a name. Because there isn't a lot of names for these things, you can give them your own names. This is all stuff you can discover for yourselves. It's not as if... There are very few books that tell you this stuff, if any, that really tell you much that's helpful. And then the third general thing is that in Nabokov, in his essay, it's called Good Readers, Good Writers, or something like that, in the book Lectures on Literature. It was originally published in Esquire magazine as How to Read, I think. But he says good readers are rereaders. This may seem obvious or not to you, but generally you don't begin to enter a text until you've read it three or four times. Carefully, with different colored pens, it helps to do it, you know, mark it up a lot. He talks about, and this is my sort of interpretation of a gloss on what he says about this one. He says that reading a novel or a story or an essay or a long one is a serial experience. It's a diachronic experience. You begin at one end and you go to the other and you experience it serially. Okay, the first time you read it. Okay, but the object is to have read it enough and know it well enough that it becomes a simultaneous object for you. So that reading a novel is like looking at a painting. Because a painting, you can look at it on the wall and you get the experience of the whole thing all at once. And when you read a novel one time, you don't get that. If you read it more than once and start to notice how it works, you get this sense of it as a simultaneous object. The novel is an odd thing. It's a temporal thing, but it's also a thing that is static. The words sit there on the same pages each time. And as a writer, you want to be able to see how the whole thing works as a static object. You want to be able to ignore the time flow at some level. I mean, it somewhat destroys the work, but you have to be able at a certain point to abstract it slightly from the temporal experience and see all the patterns as they exist. Okay. So over time, I've evolved this little reading rubric, which helps people stop themselves from doing what they normally do and allows them to begin to approach the text as just a text, as just something to look at very carefully and see it for itself. And so you start by making yourself as sort of as naive as possible. Stop this knowing interpretation of things. Stop thinking that you can figure things out. Don't figure things out to start with. And it's amazing how few people actually do this, all right? So start by simply looking at the physical story. Now, when you get your stories back from me, when I've workshopped them or your essays, whatever I'm working on, you'll see a little notation at the top. I start out by looking at the back and seeing how long the stupid thing is. Okay, nobody else does that, you know? And then I put the point of view and name the point of view, and then I put the tense up there, okay? You know, you ground yourself in the stupid story, you know? You just sort of say, what's happening here at a really basic level? How long is it? It's crucial to know how long things are if you're trying to learn how to write. You know, War and Peace is 800 pages or more, or whatever it is. But, you know, my novels, for example, run to about 180, 190 printed pages. They're very different. And I'm not trying to write that sort of thing. And it's a different pacing, and it's a different kind of scene structure. And a different number of character points of view. You know, length makes a difference, okay? How is a text divided up? You know, a story, you'll find stories are divided up with, you know, line breaks. I'll be damned if any student ever looks at a line break for me and says, you know, why the hell is that there? You know, how many are there? How do they relate to the action of the story? You know, how is the author breaking up the text? Why is it broken up? How does that line break function? Is it just a time switch? Okay, or is it a plot switch? Is it a point of view switch? Okay. But you guys don't, you see, because you're not just even looking at the physical story, you're not paying attention to the things at that level. Because you want to jump quickly to what the story's about. Okay, we're not even talking about that. I haven't even read a first line of the story yet, and I'm seeing counting the line breaks. I count everything. See if it's divided. How the division is accomplished technically. Then, you know, in novels you'll get chapters. All right, it's broken up. Chapters can be broken up with line breaks. You know, Jeanette Winterson's Sexing the Cherry has different kinds of fruit at the beginning of each section. That's a signal as to whose point of view it is and stuff like that. You look for stuff like that. And you make note of it. Second, and this is still before you try to interpret anything, okay, as I say, I put the point of view up. Analyze the point of view structure. Nobody does this right off. I don't see anybody doing it kind of pro forma, you know, as a matter of course. What is the point of view? Who is it? Name the person. And then you start, as you're going through the story or the novel or whatever, list the other characters as they come up and how they relate to the point of view character, all right? Examining the point of view structure also means you find out, like, if it's multiple character point of view, if it's an elastic third, you want to describe this. Does it go in and then out and then in and out? Make a note of this before. These are all things you can say about the story before you interpret it. And then at this point, it's very helpful to summarize the plot of the story to yourself. Just summarize the story, a really quick one. You know, I had a lot of fun learning how to do this. I used to write 250-word novel reviews for a magazine in Canada. And I got quite good at writing a complete summary of the novel, giving a couple of structural points, and then a small critique in 250 words. That's like one typed page. And that's what you want to do. You want to learn how to, you know, boil the whole thing down. Look for the essential structure of the story, the essential story of the story. Who does what to who, and how does that happen? Then, on the fourth item, keep careful track of words, ideas. This is starting to be more crucial, seeing how things work. Keep careful track of words, ideas, images, grammatical structures that repeat. Okay. But do not try to draw any conclusions about why they repeat yet. Because people tend to start thinking, symbol, as soon as they think of repeating. Don't do that. Track, note, and number the instances of important repeated elements, including image patterns. And again, I'd like people to count. One of the reasons for counting things, and I made somebody do this. I remember one person was writing an essay about Raymond Carver's story. And it was a cathedral, I think. And I forget which one. I think it was the word hands. She said in one draft of her, it was a critical thesis, that the word hands repeats a lot. So I made her go back and count the number of times the word hands repeated. And then also, as a footnote, quote all of them for me. And it ended up being about half a page of quotations in 10-point type. And the reason for that is because if you just say something general, like it repeats a lot, it's, you know, fucking good, isn't it? I swear a lot. They can't put my lectures up on the web, you know that. It doesn't do you any good to say it repeats a lot, because you want to know, as learning writers, how forced an author will be with a technique. You know, it's going to educate you. Raymond Carver repeats that word so many times that, you know, it begins to look like an experimental story or a poem after a while. But it's really fiction. And the first time you read it, it seems like relatively realistic fiction. Okay. The second time, or third time, the fourth time you read it, you begin to see the patterns and you realize how much he's forcing words and patterns and issues on the story. And you begin to wonder why. But, you know, there it is. There's an option. It can be like you can repeat this word 50 times in a 10-page story. And it will work. Okay, the numbers are very important. It's really interesting to work at novels this way, and there's a reading technique that I call cumulative pagination that you should all start, which is when you start to see something repeating in the novel, you underline it, and then you read back and find the earlier instances, and you find the very first one, and you mark it, and on that page you find the next one, you put the page for the next one, okay? And the next one, you put the first page, and then you put the page for the next one. And you accumulate the pages, so at the very last instance of the image in the novel, you have every page that it appears on in the whole book, okay? It can be an image, or it can be some sort of other structure, okay? That way, you, as a reader, can then go back and read the novel for the image, and not... You have to keep searching around, and you'll know exactly where it is. You'll know exactly in which scenes and chapters it appears. You'll get a sense of exactly how many times it appears. And you still haven't interpreted the stupid thing, but you're beginning to see how the author puts it in. Okay. Same thing for if you're reading a novel. This also works for that. Obviously works for CNF, which is often image-based. Okay. And again, I ask people to read and count the number of times a particular word appears, and it's sometimes very shocking to people. I'm sorry it's really hot in here, but I can't talk over this fan. Right. I know some of you guys are sweating. Where was I? In novels, it's also very important to look at subplot structures, okay? But in exactly this way, you have not read for the subplot. If you cannot show me the two words where main plot ends and subplot text begins, and where subplot text ends and main plot begins. If you can't show me that, then you don't know how to put a subplot in. I mean, you haven't seen how this author put it in, okay? So you and the various techniques for putting it in. So you want to, you know, look and see. You want to be able to nail that sort of thing. This is reading for technique, this is reading for structure, and this is reading the exact words. We still haven't interpreted anything. I still haven't asked you what the story is about yet. Okay, there's that. Oh, repetitive grammatical patterns, you want to start seeing those. You know, this is the way I learned my famous but construction. I began to notice how often the word but repeated in Alice Munro stories, and then all of a sudden I said, oh, there's something going on here. And then I realized how crucial that was to writing exciting sentences and so on and so forth. There's another one that I track all the time, which is the just as construction. It's lovely to see how authors use this da-da-da-da-da, just as da-da-da-da-da. Okay. The then-now construction is another one. It's a time construction you see very often in stories and novels. It's a very beautiful way of condensing story in backfill, then and now. Then I did this, now I do this. You start to see those things, okay? When I read anything, I circle every time there's a word but, by the way. My boys look and say, oh yeah, Dad's been reading this book. It's like it's a little nervous habit, you know? I haven't read the damn page if I haven't circled all the words that are but. Then in the fifth, how am I doing for time? Time flow. Okay, this is really important to understanding the structure of a story. Okay, only at this step should you begin to think about more conceptual, structural, but not thematic issues. Here you should begin by seeing how the sequences in which events are told relates to the basic chronology of events. Very few people just sit down and abstract from the story, or, you know, if it's a narrative essay, okay, a memoir, something like that. There's always a difference between the real chronology, the base chronology of what's going on, and the order in which the events are told. Okay, in a story or a novel, there's backfill, which takes you back beyond the beginning of the text, okay? That's part of the base chronology of the story. So you kind of look at the story and say, where does it begin? 1922, okay? But the text, the present action of the story all takes place in 2009. That's important to see. It's important to make relations because, again, it allows you to see the varieties that authors will deploy. So it's always very interesting for my students. Like I use a story called The Point a lot, where if you look at the time flow, it takes place over a couple of hours. This little boy gets assigned to take a drunken woman home down the beach from a party. It takes him about an hour and a half, maybe, or maybe it's just an hour, it's hard to tell, to get her down the beach, okay? But the story also contains, it's mentioned that his father was in Vietnam, his father was the one who started him doing this, and his father's killed himself. We get Mrs. Gurney home, and then Kurt goes home and starts to get into bed, but then he gets up and goes out, and all of a sudden he's remembering his father's letters from Vietnam, remembering his father's suicide, which all took place before the story. The backfill, the background material, is all at the end of the text. It's a fascinating placement of backfill. Okay, if you're not looking for just these kinds of structures, you're not really going to pay much attention to that. You're going to say, oh, well, that's, I don't know, that's interesting. But this, what the story is about Kurt, you know, coming of age. And I'm saying, I don't know. Okay, so what's the time flow? Where in the story do we go backward in time? Okay, when your students get my versions of their stories back, they find that I've drawn lines through the text, and I draw arrows up and down on the side of the page. This is me analyzing time flow, okay? Because the lines are usually where scene breaks or time breaks happen, okay? And the arrows are, you know, a downward arrow in the right margin is forward-moving action of the story, and an upward arrow is backfill. This is just a rough way for me to see how the story is flowing, okay? But if you're not doing that, you're not reading the story very carefully. I mean, and so in workshop, I will say how does the time go in this story, and then everybody will have to shuffle through their pages because they haven't actually thought about it. You know, what are they thinking about? What are you thinking about? You know, what the story's about? The characters? You like the characters? She's a 16-year-old girl. She's doing this and she's doing that. Well, that seems like my daughter. I don't know. No, that's not the way it works. Okay. How much or how little? What is the backfill? What is forward-moving action? How is the backfill placed in the story? One large section, a dance of little sections, maybe very little. How much or little does the author play with the time flow? If this is a reminiscent narrator, how does the time of the telling of the story interpenetrate the story itself? When is the time of the remembering of the story? What is the scene of the remembering of the story? This is all very important information for understanding this, just the basic structure of the story. Then on 6, you go to plot. We still haven't talked about plot, so now on 6, you start thinking about the plot. And by the plot, this is different from the story summary, which I said you should do earlier. The plot is a very precise analysis of what the character wants or desires going into the story and the resistance to that desire. And then a very careful assessment of the steps, the scenes, or the events which lead to the end of the story. You find in good stories that there's always a basic single desire and a basic resistance, and that they will meet over and over and over again. And you want to be able to track that. So with Kurt taking Mrs. Gurney down the beach, you want to be able to identify each separate event when Kurt drags Mrs. Gurney up off the sand and starts her down the way home, and then she falls down in the sand again or starts taking off her clothes or whatever. She resists, okay? You don't want to just say, Mrs. Gurney resists Kurt. No, at this stage, you want to be able to say, there's this step, and then there's this step, and then there's this step, so that you can see how they increase in intensity. You can see how each character reacts to the fact that there's a mutual resistance, a desire resistance going on. You want to be able to track that. This is crucial because one common student problem is not being able to stick with one plot. That's the broken back story, where you move from plot interest to plot interest to plot interest through the story, and it doesn't manage to get any deeper. So you want to say, What's the desire? What's the resistance? And where do they meet over and over again in this, in terms of steps? And what is the... And then seven, what are the basic steps or event or plot interactions between A and B? If we conceive of the story as a series of rooms, which is the way, you know, this is something I got from Alice Munro, who talks about seeing a story as a series, as a house with a bunch of rooms, and the reader goes in and goes from room to room to room. Okay. If you conceive of the story as a series of rooms in which A and B get together again and again and again, what is the nature of these rooms, occasions, events? And be careful here to stick to the text, exactly what the author tells us on the page. Do not move to speculating on what the author means by doing such and such, such and such. Stop yourself at simply stating what the author says. And in my student critical essays, I love quotations. Okay, quote, 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 quote. You know, I love that. I also believe, you know, if you're trying to learn a technique, that there's nothing like retyping it over and over and over again to learn it, you know, to imprint it on your minds. And finally, the last stage of this of the reading rubric is make comparisons. Okay, at this stage, you can sort of step back a little because it's very important to start having your own sort of catalog of stories and novels and essays and poems for people like that. Make comparisons. Make some judgment as to what type of story this is. Okay, and again, in workshop, people rarely do this. They don't step back. I think probably they're afraid of saying this is a romance or something. It doesn't matter. What type of story this is? Is it a love story? Is it an historical epic? Is it a comic? Be naive and even superficial here. Just put a name to things, and it can be your own name. Try to recall other stories that are similar. It's very important at this stage to start comparing. Okay, you want to see how different authors apply form and apply devices because they're infinitely variable. That's the confusing thing, is you keep thinking you're seeing different forms. In fact, you're just seeing variations of the same forms over and over and over again. And this is what I want you to try to see. You've got to see the woods for the trees, or the trees for the woods. Forest for the trees.
Trees in the forest.
Something like this, you know. In your mind, compare and contrast how different authors handle similar sorts of structures, actions, and genres. And that, all that you can tell me about without interpreting a single damn word and mentioning the word symbol. Okay. All right. I was going to hand out, but Melissa said I had to kind of keep it short. I do give my students a cheat sheet, kind of fill-in form for reading, you know. But not really. Okay, now, I have to move along, right along, okay. This is something I got from Laura Rose, because she wrote her, y'all gotta go to her lecture, because she does a lecture on a certain topic, a technical topic, and then she thought, you know, well, there must be people who don't do this very well, and it might be helpful to show students how it's badly done. And so I thought it'd be great to show you some bad readings of a story. So I've got at the end the Elizabeth Talent story. It's in this version, it's a little three-page story. It's really just two pages. What we have here are these are essays like I did not. These are not student essays. You know, if you go on the web, you can find essays of all sorts of. But this is very. These essays all make common student mistakes. Okay, so we'll just go through a little bit. You can have examples here. But here is the one. The Elizabeth Talent story is a very short story. It's a two-page story. This girl and her older boyfriend are driving down the road in a truck. They're having an affair. She's quite young. It's her 18th birthday. He's given her a diary for her birthday, but the lock's broken. His wife shows up in a car coming the other way, and he pushes her down to keep her out of sight. And on the radio is Roseanne Cash singing a song in which the words are something, something, no one's a mystery. That's the title of the story. And then finally the wife goes by and she can sit up again, okay? And then the story transitions into this very beautiful discussion of their future through the diary. You know, what will you write? What will you write? And she says what she will write, and then he says what he will write, and then we're out of the story. And it's a beautiful little story. Okay, very short. Okay, this person wrote, this concise short story is charged with characterization. talent's authorial voice. Of course it's the authorial voice. I mean, Jesus Christ, she wrote the stupid thing. Is assured. I love the students who like to applaud the story, you know, and tell me the great writer, Leo Tolstoy. or the well-known. I love the well-known writer, Leo Tolstoy. Not a word is wasted. She strikes a balance with regard to imagery and dialogue. You realize that this means absolutely dick all, right? Charged, assured, not a word wasted, balance, and a little later on the paragraph, none of the details appears extraneous. What exactly would an extraneous detail look like, and how would we know? And, oh, Jesus. Anyway, but believe me, you all write stories, essays a little bit like this. At some time or other.
Never, never.
Never, never. Hmm. Okay. Okay, and her details, this it's just sort of baffle gab. The 18-year-old girl narrator remembers this day vividly. Now, in fact, there's nothing in the text about her remembering this. The word, you know, is not there. She doesn't go into the future, okay? That's not there. For one obvious reason, it is her birthday. Again, you know, the person who's reading the story is imagining that she's remembering the story, but that's not in the text. And she's remembering it because, of course, it's her 18th birthday, and she would remember that. That's not in the text. There's nothing there about that, okay? So this is all junk. Then telling you, okay, we'll go on. None of the details appears. It's all motivated by opening tension marked out by Talent's plot device, Jack's wife. Wife's Cadillac approaches in the distance. Now, that's the only thing in the first paragraph that's vaguely close to saying something interestingly technical, I'll pick is, because the opening segment of the story, there is a tension, a scenic tension, which I call interference, to separate it from actual plot conflict tension, because the plot conflict of the story is between the girl and the guy. The wife showing up is interference, okay? It interferes with their scene together and causes them to do a bunch of action. So it's a sort of a plot device, but it's not plot line, okay? So you make distinctions like that, you know, how is this really working in this? And if you're not just looking at the story, you don't start to make assumptions like that. So that's vaguely correct there. It's pretty smart, okay? He pushes the girl's head down, and then she sees a bunch of details because she's got nothing to do but look at the floor. They've been drinking. It's kind of a comic story, too. It's cute. Then the next paragraph, not only the description of Jack gives his character away. I love it when you say things like gives his character away, because it's as if somebody was hiding something in the story, you know. But the author is writing the story, and nothing is being concealed. The author is telling you exactly what she wants you to read. Dialogue is revelatory. This is a stunning perception. And beyond revealing what it actually says, I don't know what else it reveals. We hear the things that bug him about his wife. Yeah, yeah. Leave the headlights on in your drive. Yeah, yeah, he doesn't like his wife. Then there's this interesting going down a bit. She says she sees the pop tops on the floor and says that the kid could cut himself or something. And this, the writer says, this triggers the central action. Triggers is, you know, one of those pseudo-technical terms that students like to use. Again, it doesn't really mean much. And in fact, this person is wrong. The talk about the pop tops on the floor does not trigger the central action of the story. The person gets right about a conflict that the central conflict is between Jack's vision of their future together and the narrator's. Okay, that's pretty correct. And then as the narrator prepares to hear Jack's version, again, this is really sloppy language. There's nothing in the story about the girl getting ready to hear Jack's version. I mean, there's no preparation. It's just stupid stuff that's being said without actually seeing what's in the text. We'll skip a little. There's a moment when she looks out at the prairie outside the truck, and she uses the word fawn-colored. And this person jumps on that word fawn, actually quite correctly. So, I mean, that's not bad, okay, except that, you know, this essay is not really focusing on any one subject, but she, you know, whoever wrote it gives us 5 lines about the word fawn, and it's pretty nice, actually. She's right, or he's right. But then ruins it by saying, from her youthful, innocent perspective, the world is a fertile, dazzling, romantic place about to come into flower, which is nothing. There's nothing about that in the text. Okay, I don't even know. She's 18, but I'm not even sure that we're meant to see her as innocent. And then another one of the essays, the word naive comes up all the time. I don't think she's naive. I think she kind of is trying to make things happen. But anyway, that doesn't matter. It's not there in the text. Then the next piece is what happens is very often is you just get a story summary, okay, rather than look at the technical thing, okay? And then the end, and so the story finishes, and then we get more garbage writing. Open-ended, inviting us readers to decide on their fate. The story's central themes are left for us to ponder. How predictable are we? Can people change their ways? Are young people fated to be perpetually naive? Are older people doomed to fatalism and cynicism? Whose version of the future is truer? What are the implications? You know, this has just got nothing to do with anything. Don't, you know, if you find yourself doing that, you're wrong. You know, you're just off topic. You know, you're not wrong. Because, you know, that's part of enjoying the story, but it's not learning to read as a writer. How am I doing? Okay, I'm going to actually let you read those yourselves. There's more, okay. And with my acerbic comments. Okay, then turn to the story itself. And I've just tried to go through and tell you, show you some of the things you can say about this story without ever doing any of the things that the writers earlier on have talked about. You know, without talking about character, without talking about theme, without talking about interpretation. By the way, the diary, there's one kind of neat section there where I picked out two different writers who had two different ideas of what the diary was a symbol of, okay? And it beats the hell out of me that you would think the diary is a symbol. I mean, it's just a diary, but, you know, there's no... They just want to interpret things, and they both have two quite different ideas of what the diary means, neither one of which is written into the text. Okay, so we have No One's a Mystery, all right? And what you see is, I use the word figures, but, you know, I'm not perfect. Also, I noticed there are some spelling mistakes, but I was, you know, half asleep when I did this. So there's my, in the first top left-hand corner, first person narrator, 18-year-old, female, unnamed, past tense. Oh, one of the essays I found gave her a name. how well that reader read the essay. She was Mary, asking, who is Mary? And I had to reread the story very carefully, even though I read it a dozen times. Where is Mary in the story? So it's her 18th birthday, and he's given her the diary. And she's scratching at the lock, which doesn't seem to work. This is the first of a run of not very many, but enough little details of the scene that aren't quite right, okay, that give a kind of anxiety to the background. When he thought he saw his wife's Cadillac in the distance, this is all very quick. Boom. Birthday, diary, wife. The wife, as I say, is the interference for the main scene, first scene. He pushes her down to the floor, the dirty floor of the pickup, and kept one hand on my head. I love this. While I inhaled the musk of his cigarettes in the dashboard ashtray and sang along with Roseanne Cash on the tape deck. She's a little drunk. We'd been drinking tequila, and the bottle was between his legs, resting against his crotch, where the seam of his Levi's was bleached linen white, though the Levi's... Now, this is the beginning. Now, the person in the essay remarked on these details, okay? But what the person didn't notice is that there's a pattern of detail passages, okay? There's 3 passages that are exactly like this, where suddenly the narrator looks either in the truck, twice it's within the truck and once it's looking outside the truck. And there's about exactly the same amount of lineage given to these details. And they're spaced kind of rhythmically through the text. It's really quite a beautiful little effect. And if you did it just once, you would be very... You know, there's a kind of unconscious way you don't convince the reader that you know what you're doing. If you do it three times like that, there's a kind of authoritativeness to the structure, okay? And again, it moves. It's a point of view movement, okay? It's action at the level of point of view. Suddenly my face is down in the dirt and I'm looking at the details. In this case, the details also have an erotic tinge because she's looking at his crotch, she's got the bottle sticking up. Oh, sorry. And, you know, she is so attentive that she knows, you know, how the seams of his crotch fade. I find that erotic. And I think it's, you know, clearly meant, but never mind, we don't have to go. I mean, you don't want to interpret, but it's there. The other characters, I say, the conflict expressed in the action, when he pushes her head down, we have a clear incarnation of their conflicted relationship. We don't need to get feminist about this or interpret this at all. I mean, he's who he is. They're doing this together. All this eroticism. Okay. Then we get the dialogue. It's her, so on. And what we have here, and you'll see this through the whole essay, it's a marvelous story of concision. Okay. And one of the dramatic things, of course, is the dialogue. And the dialogue uses certain sorts of techniques. If you're not paying attention to structure, you don't see the techniques. The technique here is that the dialogue is very often very carefully not answering. The conflict is expressed in people talking in a conflicted way, but not necessarily arguing with each other, but ignoring each other or inserting questions rather than responding. Okay, in this case, it's a not answering by the use of questions. As you go down through the story, you'll just see over and over again devices of not answering. We get a first nice little repetition of the word safer. She thinks it's safer. Why does she need to be safer? Repetition is very important, even if you start to see it in dialogue, you know, you start to notice it, all right? Because there's a pattern of word repetition all through the story. It's just starting up here. The conflict of the story between the narrator and Jack, she wants to believe in the romantic future for them, and he does not believe in it. There are basically two scenes, each of which has its own interference or secondary conflict, something that drives the dramatic interest of the scene and also expresses the main conflict. The first scene uses Jack's wife driving by. The second scene uses the diary. Okay, we're still with the wife going by. What we have here is a nice little run of parallel constructions. Parallel constructions play a big part in the story. She'll see your lips move, Jack. She'll know you're talking to someone. And then he picks up. She'll think, I'm sending it along the radio. Parallel constructions are very beautiful. They give a story a piece of writing of rhythm. Okay, and in this case, we have the parallel construction carry from one speaker to the next speaker. So there's a tie-in between the two in the grammatical structure. Again, there's dialogue not answering. In this case, by repeating the words, another technique of not answering is just to repeat the words of the other person. She'll know, she'll see, she'll think. We have in this section the words of the title, the Roseanne Cash song, which is a little motif, okay? There's no backfill in the story, you pay attention to that. There is only this one little mention here, the same boots he'd been wearing for the 2 years I'd known him. Okay, that's the only backfill in this story, okay? It's crucial to know that because you can write a story without any backfill except for this half a line. There's characterization by contrast, you know, it's a real sort of the contrast between Jack and his wife. Jack drives fast and recklessly and his wife obeys all the rules, so on and so forth. That's going on there. There's the second passage of concrete detail. I studied his boots, the elk heads stitched into the leather, so on and so forth, and then the Roseanne Cash song. Then there's the dialogue technique of not answering by indirection. Do you think she's getting famous? You know, they're talking about the wife, and then suddenly Jack says, do you think she's getting famous because of who her daddy is or for herself? And then she replies, there are about 100 pop tops on the floor. Did you know that? Some little kid could cut a bare foot. If talent, the writer, had just answered that question, do you think she's getting famous? It would have been dead on the page, okay? This technique of not answering is really important for learning, for writing. dramatic dialogue, okay? And then we get an interesting run of the word kid, because that's going to be, you know, that ends up being important, not the word kid itself, but... So some little kid cut his barefoot. No little kids get into this truck except for you. Yes. How come you let it get so dirty? How come, he mocked again, not answering by repeating the words of the other character, in this case in a mocking way. And then, you even sound like a kid. So we get the word kid three times coming fast together. See, repetition, concision, parallel structure, not answering already. We have all these techniques jumping around. We haven't talked about what the story is really about, you know, except in a very general way yet. If you don't start noticing things like this, you're not going to learn. Now, what we have here is the basic transition. There's a line through the text, if you can see it. I say structural transition, okay? We now don't hear any more of the wife, and we shift over to the diary discussion. So they triple over the kids. Oh, okay. How do you know? She's not going to look over her shoulder and see you. How do you know? I just know, he said. Like I know I'm going to get meatloaf for supper. It's in the air. Like I know what you'll be writing in that diary. Here's the transition, right? I know what you'll be writing in the diary. What will I be writing? See, I know what I will be writing, Repetition. And then we get the third passage of detail. Okay, and this time she looks out the window. Okay, why does she do that, you think? What's going on? To me, it's primarily a rhythmic device. You know, on one level, it's a slight pause. Okay, it's a slight pulling out from the action. It's looking at some concrete details which are evocative of something or other. And it's a little taking of a breath. It's a lovely sort of dramatic thing. Well, maybe, but I don't want to think that the author is sitting there thinking about what the reader's doing. You know, I think the author is feeling a rhythm. And then what we get is, after that, we get two gorgeous parallel passages of parallel constructions, okay? This is where it starts to read like almost like a formal poem, okay? Tonight you'll write, I love you, I love Jack. This is my birthday present from him. I can't imagine anybody loving anybody more than I love Jack. I can't. In a year, you'll write, I wonder what I ever really saw in Jack. I wonder why I spent so many days just riding around in his pickup. It's true he taught me something about sex. It's true there wasn't ever much else to do in Cheyenne. I won't write that. In 2 years, you'll write, I wonder what the old guy's name was, the one with the curly hair and the filthy pickup truck. And time on his hands. Okay, that's Jack telling her what. And she keeps saying, I won't, I won't, I won't. And see the parallel structures is tonight you'll write, in a year you'll write. See how we shoot into the future with those parallels, okay? Very formal, but beautiful. I won't write that. Then the question transition, no. And so notice how she's repeated, I won't write that, I won't write that. Second block of parallels. Tonight, it's her. Tonight, I'll write, I love Jack. This is my birthday present from him. I can't imagine anybody loving anybody more than I love Jack. No, you can't, he said. You can't imagine it. In a year, I'll write, Jack should be home any minute now. Anyway, you can read it. And then in 2 years, I'll write, in 3 years, I'll write, my nipples are a little sore from nursing Eliza Rosamund. And then he says, Rosamund, you see, you know, that's a Greek rhetorical device, a very ancient primitive device called anadiplosis. You use the last word of a section to begin the next section, okay? If you've got to start reading so that you know that this stuff is, you know, it's not standard, it's classical, it's ancient rhetorical practice, okay? And you learn to use it for yourselves. The other obvious one is in the very last section is epanalepsis, where she begins the section with words, her breath smells like, and then we end, and her breath would smell like, okay? You see how the her breath smelling, like, bookend this section? That's called epanalepsis. So we have these blocks of parallels, And then the last section in which we have a panalepsis and then more parallels, but I believe mine, not in your heart of hearts, you're wrong, I'm not wrong. See how much repeats in that last section. This is such a formal production and so emotional and intense and concise at the same time, okay? And if you're not reading for this technique, you will not learn how to write this, okay? The parallels and the repetitions create a rhythmic intensity that pushes you closer and closer and closer to this very emotional climax, okay? And this is very sort of sad and beautiful climax, and I don't care what it means, you know, I don't have any. But okay, so that's that. And now we'll now, there's more stuff in here that you can read, okay? And all this I've talked about is without talking about the meaning of the story or the character of the characters, okay? You can write me a long essay before you tell me that the girl's anything more than 18. And the word naive is not in the story, you know? I don't think she's naive, actually. I think she knows exactly what's going on, but that's me interpreting. Never mind. I just don't want to hear anybody tell me that she's naive. Okay, I'm going to stop and you can ask me questions now. How am I doing? I'm done. So you get 3 minutes for questions, yeah?
I found this very helpful as what not to. Do you have any critical thoughts about what you look at that are just perfect?
Well, as a matter of fact, you know, they've given us, or they're trying to give us web pages to use with our students, and I have been working on mine. In fact, I think we're actually getting rid of this software and getting new software. This is all experimental. But I'm starting to put up examples of web pages for my particular students. I've been trying to, over time, gather student essays that are good and keep them to show them as examples.
Are there any reference books that you can refer to?
No. But, okay, there's some really interesting... Okay, if you look at Nabokov's lectures on literature, these are his lecture notes from a book course that he taught at Cornell. And Nabokov is very good at reading for technique and structure. So if you just, the first one is on Mansfield Park, and then there's one on Bleak House and one on Madame Bovary. And you see they have facsimiles of the maps he drew of the stories, you know, of scenes in the stories. And you see him concentrating on structure and technique. That's a good person to look at. John Berryman, the poet, is actually one of my favorite critics because he is so energetic and available to structural information. There's one crucial essay that he wrote on Thomas Nash's proto-novel, The Unfortunate Traveler, which I always used as a touchstone myself. It's in, The Freedom of the Poet? Is that his book of essays? I think, yeah. He also wrote a really interesting critical biography of Stephen Crane. He also there's a wonderful book of his stuff on Shakespeare. Never mind. Berryman is amazing. Yeah, what?
Where do you think Eddie Krause
is? Of who?
Eddie Krause's book.
Francine Krause's
book. How to Read Like a
Woman. You know, I haven't read it. I don't know. Yeah. But there's other things like, you know, I don't know. You kind of look around in this self-exploration. I mean, and I meant that last little bit to show you how to read things in a positive way. Okay. Well, I have a nice essay of mine that about a Canadian writer, about one of his stories in which I pull out all the rhetorical devices that he uses. If you want, I can send you a PDF of the published version. It has a list of rhetorical devices at the end with definitions and things.
I was just going to talk about a practical device that I use. You were talking about reading novels, you know, and writing critical essays on novels. One of the things that I did when I was writing my critical essays is I'd read a novel first, and as I became aware of repetition, I'd plug in post-it notes, and I kept a spiral notebook. Before I was reading, and so I would write down these little examples, you know, and then I'd mark the page number. I got really bad about writing in the books too, markers, so I had to end up buying everything.
Well, I think you should, yeah.
Yeah, you know, little pencil marks.
Yeah.
But then when it came back time to go back to write the critical essay, I had like this little outline thing in a notebook that would say, you know, examples of expository dialogue,
yeah.
For example. And I would have, you know, slide, okay, on page 72, it shows up on page 124. And the post-it notes had marked it so I could go back and find
yeah.
it very quickly. And it really helped with writing it.
Yeah, I do use post-it notes. The trouble with them is that they fall out over the years. So I also
they only stayed in there long enough for the credit glass.
Yeah.
So you always write in the book?
Yeah. I was.
Because I was gonna that whole thing about I always read the same way every time. But then a good writer is a rereader.
Yes.
Something like that. So it's hard to notice everything. You know, because we do read for pleasure.
Right.
And there is pleasure in extracting details, but you do have to do it a lot. You know, you have to, there's layers
yes.
of understanding.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and yeah, I mean, there's yeah. stories that I reread over and over and over again and still find new stuff. I try to read with a different colored pen each time, which is kind of fun, because then I start to sort of notice the layers of perception, too. But yeah, but things of mine that I've read a lot are just completely marked up. And if I see a book opens up and you've got two pages, but it's kind of fun just to draw lines between the words on the different pages. So I have these squares or triangles or spiders on the page.
So you ever go out and buy a new copy?
No, I can't because everything's there on the copy. God, I had a flood. My copy of Mansfield Park is faded because it got caught in a flood, and the pages are all spongy, and I can just barely make out my lines, and I can't lose that book.
I do it in pencil because I don't want to lose the freshness of the text.
Oh, no, I enjoy the marked up text a lot. Yeah. Any other?
Yeah, I would just comment and go back to what you said about quoting the text, you know, parenthetical references to the text, and just so happens as a place to start. Critical essay, you know, the ones that you show as bad examples, they don't quote the text at all.
That's right.
And kind of the rule of writing is show me, don't tell
yeah.
me. And that's a way in a critical essay, I think, to show you. You know, if you say this, then damn it, show me.
Exactly.
Give me words out of the text that
yeah.
made you think that, or give me the number of things, times you repeated and stuff like that. So, you know, a place to start, maybe that's a good place to start.
Well, it is to always be quoting things, yeah.
As you read your own work and kind of self-edit, do you do the same things?
No. No, that's a different exercise, I think, in a sense, because I'm not in there trying to see what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing, you know.
But like that example of the dialogue and not... And saying,
not answering?
Yeah, not answering. Like, do you ever look to...
Because
I read that and I was like, oh, I could do that.
Do I ever look to...
To text, to do it to yourself, to your own work, or find a... If you're struggling with a scene...
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, but more in the past, when I was teaching myself earlier on, I always... When I got into a problem, I could identify a problem, go straight to the library,
yeah.
and start, you know... So one time I remember spending a day in the library reading nothing but the endings, last paragraphs of stories. Or my first published novel, I had a problem. It was a comic detective novel sort of thing. And I had a broken back plot. I didn't realize until I was in the third draft that, in fact, what happened was that there was a problem with the plot. That is, he starts out investigating something and can't get anywhere, so he gives up. And then starts doing something else, which then comes back. So... And I thought, oh, fuck, I really fucked this one up. You know, how did... And then I went and read novels until I found out that, in fact, it's a standard. It's a standard variation, and you find people who do it. And then I just read the paragraphs where they shifted from one plot to the next to see how they did the alignment, you know. And then I did it. Or dialogue, yeah. I mean, that's the reason you look at dialogue, so you can use it. The only reason you look at the story like this is so that you can use it yourself. Yeah. And you look at dialogue and you say, what is going on here? What is the structure of this dialogue that I can actually use as a template? That's what a device is, okay? That's what a form is. It's a template that you can fill up with your own content. Okay. One more, and I think we should quit.
I really liked your idea, too, of typing out the quotes and stuff, because I did that once with some students of mine where I was typing out examples. authors that I like. One of the things that happened was it's almost like a channeling process.
Yeah.
I'm typing it out word for word, and then I found myself going, I would want to choose this word, but why did she choose this?
Yeah.
Why did she go this way?
Oh, yeah.
And so I started questioning what the author had done on the page, and then it made me think about, well, why did I want to do it in a different way? And it's very, very useful.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Oh, yeah, I do think typing things out. Anyway, thank you.